Blog Talk Radio.
Sing through my voice, play through my hands, let the way be
Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. I'm Karen Tate, and tonight's musical offering, opening the show, was just a little bit of a really wonderful song by Abigail Spinner, and it was called Let the Way Be Open. Thank you so much, Abigail. But let's turn our attention to tonight's show. In the spirit of Howard Zinn, we have, I hope, for you at the top of the hour, because he's actually not called in yet, Thaddeus Russell, formerly a professor at Barnard College, author of Renegade History of the United States, which should satisfy listeners who love hidden history and unsung heroes and heroines. I'm hoping we're going to get to hear him discuss the topic we chose for tonight, Bad Women. Women made America the home of the free. As Thaddeus turns myths of the American character on their head, as he discusses how prostitutes in the 19th century won many freedoms for today's women, and how poor immigrant women were the vanguard of the consumer revolution that radically transformed and liberated the lives of all Americans. And at the bottom of the hour, unless it gets pushed to the top, we're going to hear Art Noble, author of The Sacred Female, a sonata of sexual love and spirituality, discuss there's more to sex than you think as he covers taboo subjects such as female ejaculation, sex, sexual love, female sexual responses, transcendent sex, sexual energy, sexual myth and misogyny and sexual history. And he's even going to tell us where we can find in the Bible references to female orgasmic ejaculation. Okay, it's odd that I'm having to have a man tell me about all of this, but you know what? That's okay. I get the impression that Art is one of our enlightened brothers out there, and I'm looking forward to talking to him. But there's just a few quick things before we get to our guest tonight. In case you haven't been listening in the last few weeks, and I'm glad you're back if that's the case, Blog Talk is no longer free to hosts like myself. Last year was a great year because Blog Talk provided us this platform free of charge. Now, hosts don't make money, but it wasn't costing them anything either. But now it's going to cost a minimum of $30 to $40 each month to keep my show as it is. So we're looking for a sponsor or even a few people who might commit to helping us pay for the show to keep us on the air. I know it's not a lot of money. It really isn't. But I figure once they start charging us, it's never going to end. So if you can send in $5, $10, $20, you know what? Every little bit helps. And I'm hoping that if you like Voices of the Sacred Feminine, if you're one of our regular listeners especially, you'll help support us. Because remember, like Goddess teaches us, what nature teaches us, what you tend to, what you nurture, what you nourish, well, it thrives, and what you neglect withers. So thanks to those of you who have already sent in donations. So here I am, like I said before, I feel like those people standing on the television on PBS during a fundraising drive, but please support us to keep us on the air. If you'd like to make a donation, please go to the Goddess Store page of my website at KarenTate.com, and there are PayPal buttons. You can make a donation of any amount that you can afford. And please, remember the three F's here at Blog Talk on my show page. I'd love it if you would mark Voices of the Sacred Feminine a favorite. Be sure to become our friend. And also click on follow. Those are the three F's, favorite, friend, and follow. If you do all of those things, you'll never miss notice of who my new guests are each week. And that way you're a part of our growing family of listeners across the globe. Also, please remember to tell your friends that there is a link on my website now that takes you to the itinerary for the sacred tour I'll be leading to Turkey, Land of the Nourishing Mothers, this November 2011. I'm taking both men and women on the trip. We'll be going to places like Istanbul, Ephesus, Çatalhöyük, Side, and Lagina, where we find Hecate's only standing temple known to modern man. We'll be doing activities like dream incubations. We'll do rituals at the site. Because, you know, there in Turkey, the places that we go to, they don't have a lot of tourists. So we end up with a lot of private time. We'll be doing Turkish baths. We'll be partaking of mineral baths near the domain of Aphrodite outside Aphrodisias, and much, much more. So if you're hearing the call for a sacred journey, whether it's to satisfy your body, mind, or soul, go to my website at KarenTate.com. People are signing up already, so if you'd like to give yourself something meaningful as a gift for the holidays or for the new year, a promise of a spiritual journey soon to come with the like-minded who all of us will be drinking in the essence of the mother in her many forms and faces. That's what we'll be doing on the trip. So join us if you feel called. We're only going to take 20 people, so don't hesitate or delay if you want to secure your place on the tour. And I'm happy that there has been good response, so I won't be surprised if the tour fills before November. So don't wait till the last minute if you think you really might want to go. And while you're there at KarenTate.com, might I invite the influx of new listeners from across town and across the globe to please check out my two books, which have garnered prestigious endorsements. The first book is Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations. The second is Walking an Ancient Path, Rebirthing Goddess on Planet Earth. Well, the first one tells you how to get to sacred places around the globe if you're a traveler, but if you're more of the armchair tourist, many reviews have been outstanding as people feel the book actually takes them there. Sacred Places of Goddess is sold everywhere, even in museum bookstores. And the other book, Walking an Ancient Path, well, it was a finalist in the spirituality category of the National Best Books Awards. It's sort of a spiritual and social and cultural, political look at what it means to embrace goddess in this day and age, how she's relevant as deity, archetype, and or ideal. Whether you're embracing these ideals or archetype or deity into your personal life or birthing her into your community. That book is also sold everywhere. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it at your local bookstore. Or you can take advantage of a special I have for my listeners. Both books are $25 plus shipping and handling. That's the two books, one of each. And I'll even sign them for you. So, you know, not a bad deal. And if you like free stuff, and we all do, well, that's on my website, too. Besides the wonderful information there and articles, the stuff there that teaches, check out the free meditations. I have one there for spring that you might want to take advantage of. There's another there that takes you to the Isis Temple in Philae. It's sort of a journey. So take a look at that. There are actually several there you might want to avail yourself of. I've gotten good feedback from them, and I'm happy to provide them for you, and I had a lot of fun doing them. And don't forget, if you're listening live, and you want to call in and talk to my fabulous guests or myself, the number is 718-766-4662. I know most of you listen from the archives, but if you want to call in when I see you on the switchboard, I'll get to you when we have a lapse in the conversation, and I will invite you to give your comment or question. I'll identify you by your area code. All right, so I still have not seen Thaddeus show up on the switchboard, so what I'm going to have to do is I'm going to have to give him a call. So what I will do is ask you listeners to please hang on with me. I am going to let you listen to another wonderful piece by Abigail McBride, who was the musician who opened the show. I'm going to play something of hers I really like called Sekhmet, for the Egyptian goddess Sekhmet. That'll give me time while you're listening to that to give Thaddeus a call and see what's happened. You never know. I just spoke to him yesterday, and we were all set to talk. But, you know, life has a way of sweeping us up. So let me have you listen to Sekhmet by Abigail Spinner McBride while I try to reach Thaddeus on another phone. So here goes. Enjoy. Thank you. Well, listeners, I hope you enjoy the opportunity to hear that song in its entirety. Sometimes we only get to hear snippets of it, and I use that time to get in touch with our first guest, Thaddeus, and I see he's actually here on the switchboard, so I am going to say hello to him and welcome him to join our chat. Hi,
hello.
Thaddeus. Are you there?
Yes, I am. Thanks for having me.
Oh, no problem. I'm glad I'm glad you were still able to do the show here. I've been hyping you all week, telling everybody that we were going to talk about the bad women that made America the land of the free. So I'm glad we were able to to actually get you here on the show. So Thaddeus, let me start by giving listeners a little bit of your bio so they have a sense of your background, and then, we'll jump right in. So listeners,
okay, sure.
Thaddeus Russell, he's a historian and a cultural critic and the author of A Renegade History of the United States. It was published by Free Press, Simon Schuster. He teaches American history and cultural studies at Occidental College and has taught history, American studies, and the history of philosophy at Columbia University, Barnard College, the New School for Social Research, and Eugene Lang College. He was born and raised in Berkeley, California, graduated from Antioch College, and received a PhD in history from Columbia University. His first book, Out of the Jungle, Jimmy Hoffa and the Remaking of the American Working Class, was published by Alfred Kampf in 2001. He's written for the Daily Beast, the New York Magazine, the Los Angeles Times, the Boston Globe, the Christian Science Monitor, Salon, lots of other publications. In fact, that's where I found him. I think I found one of his articles in Salon. He's also appeared on the History Channel in The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. So, Thaddeus, officially welcome. Glad you're here with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
One of the things that really caught my eye when I was reading your article on one of the internet publications was apparently you had a job as a teacher, and then you sort of lost that job. You weren't really... I guess towing the academic line, so to speak. Would you mind sharing that with listeners? Because we just love heretics and renegades.
sure. Yeah, I was. I taught for five years total at Barnard College. After the fourth year, I was put up for a possible tenure track position. I was not tenure track at that time. I was teaching full time, but not tenure track. But that required giving a presentation to the faculty on my work, who didn't really know what I was doing, and students did, the faculty didn't. And as a result of that talk, several faculty were very enthusiastic about it, but many faculty, especially those at Columbia across the street, who have power over Barnard's tenure decisions, were upset. Quite upset, outraged in some ways, actually called my work improper and dangerous and demanded that I be terminated, and I was from Barnard. And the good news is that I thought my career was over, but I thought I also had these lectures. I had been lecturing on the history of the United States since the Civil War for several years and was very successful with it, and students were very enthusiastic about it, and I thought, well, this might be a book. And so out of that came what is now a renegade history of the United States. It's really the basis of that book was really those lectures at Barnard. And so actually the book never would have been written if I hadn't been essentially fired from Barnard.
Well, it's interesting. You share a similar story with one of my other guests, who's a favorite here on the show, David Hillman. He got in sort of the same kind of problems. He was researching drug use in the ancient world, and they made him pull the information he discovered about drug use in the ancient world out of his thesis, and said, if you don't pull it out, you won't graduate. And he ended up turning it into a wonderful book. So both of you have, made lemonades of lemons. Yeah. what were you saying that was so dangerous? Do tell us, please.
Well, that particular talk, which actually ended up becoming a scholarly article, funny enough, it did actually pass muster with other academics. That one was about the history of black homosexuality and then its conflicts with the civil rights movement. And so I had done a lot of research on actually black drag queens who were very prominent in African-American culture from the 1930s all the way into the 1950s in every major American city where there was a large black neighborhood. In particular, New York and Chicago and Detroit, there were these drag balls and drag clubs. They were enormously popular, and in fact, Ebony and Jet, which were the two leading African-American magazines at the time, covered those drag balls almost every single week, and they did so uncritically. In fact, they were often kind of celebratory about the drag balls. Drag queens in black neighborhoods across the country were really popular and held relatively high esteem. And then in addition to that, a lot of people don't know this, but the two most popular black ministers in that period, and this is the 1940s and early 1950s, were Prophet Jones, who was a flamboyantly gay Pentecostal preacher in Detroit, and Sweet Daddy Grace, who was probably heterosexual but was flamboyant in many other ways. He had very long hair. He wore 6-inch long fingernails that he painted different colors. And wore chartreuse vests and top coats and hats and was a very flamboyant in many ways. They had enormous congregations and also were covered in Ebony and Jet on a regular basis. Life magazine covered them as well. Prophet Jones had a radio show that was broadcast across the Midwest. Sweet Daddy Grace's congregation stretched from Florida all the way up to Maine. They both had hundreds and hundreds of thousands of members of their congregations, but were also clearly the most popular ministers among sort of the black working class at the time. The civil rights leaders who emerged in the 1950s as national leaders, not just Martin Luther King, but others, attacked them because their mission, the civil rights mission, was not just desegregation, it was also integration, and more importantly, it was assimilation, which meant to adopt the norms of the dominant white culture, which of course at the time was, you know, ardently, militantly heterosexual, anti-homosexual. And so the black press turned on Prophet Jones and turned on the drag queens, turned on Sweet Daddy Grace. The black ministers who were leading the civil rights movement, including King, became openly critical of all of them. Ebony stopped covering the drag shows, started to denounce Jones and Grace. King gave sermons in black churches across the country in the late 50s. Instructing African Americans that in order to gain full citizenship, they needed to shun all forms of immorality, such as drinking and non-marital sex and gambling and homosexuality. And so there was this very conservative impulse within the civil rights movement that most people don't know about, that most historians don't write about. And that's now a chapter in Renegade History, but that was at the time what I presented to the faculty at Barnard and Columbia. And they, for various reasons, were appalled by it and outraged and just thought it had no place in academic discourse or in the university, I think partly because I was saying things about black sexuality that are not allowed in civil discourse. You're supposed to present African-Americans as being ultra-respectable for fear of playing into old stereotypes, of course, about primitive black sexuality. And also because King is a fairly sacred personage in American culture, but also in the academy. So that's why I was pumped. But I have found a place back in academia, and I'm now teaching again at Occidental out here in L.A.
Well, that's good. Well, you know, I increasingly seem to stumble upon these sorts of situations, and I guess I'm not quite so naive as I used to be, but, you know, I thought history was history and teaching was teaching, and if it was true, well, how could you get in trouble for teaching it? You know, unless, of course, I don't know, maybe you're teaching at a Christian college and you're saying, you know, Christianity is the scourge of the earth or something, but I don't know, how does academia justify something like that? You know, if it happened, it happened. It's history. I mean, it's almost your obligation to sort of give the context for the time, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I don't actually believe that there's such a thing as truth in any way, and in particular in teaching history. I don't think there's any historical truth. I don't think that what I write is any more true than anything else. I think that everything is basically a narrative that comes out of the author's own experience, own interpretation of the world. I don't think that anything is more true than anything else. But there's no question, even those who do believe in truth in academia have long been aware that virtually every single decision made in academia is political, that it's all based upon one's own politics and what one would like to see presented, you know, in sort of the elite discourse that dominates sort of much of our intellectual world. So for, you know, for about a century, of course, colleges and universities were dominated by straight white elite men, and the histories that they taught were, you know, those of presidents and generals and great inventors, et cetera, and women were completely written out, and African Americans were written out, you know, not to mention Asian Americans and the rest. And that generation, all but that decision, all those decisions were political as well. The reason that that kind of history was written was that those men had a particular political viewpoint, which was that they should run the world,
right.
And that no one else should be included in it. Now they were overturned in the 60s and 1970s by, of course, the generation that came of age with the anti-war movement, with the feminist movement, with the civil rights movement, etc. And they replaced that whole crew of old white men with a lot of white men, but more women came in, more people of color came in, but more importantly, they started to rewrite history. But again, that, whether you like it or not, and a lot of that history I value very much and I learn from it, it is all also chosen for political reasons, not actually because it's more or less true than anything else, in my view. But there's no question that every decision that's made is political. And what I was doing was challenging that newer generation's view of history, because, of course, I was taking on, you know, one of the major icons of the 1960s generation, who was Martin Luther King, and showing that a lot of his politics was actually quite conservative and actually quite critical and hostile to African Americans' lives and cultures.
I see. Well, I know it just disturbs me, you know, when I hear stuff like that, you know, for instance, you know, we're hearing now about how, you know, the Texas history books are being rewritten, you know, maybe to exclude Thomas Jefferson and, you know, play down slavery. And, you know, I guess I just wonder, you know, how, I don't know, again, call it my naivete, I guess I just, I think that's a sin, quite frankly. And I just can't imagine doing something like that. But I guess if Thomas Jefferson makes your political views look pretty regressive, then maybe I guess you do that. But I don't know. I guess I'm a servant to knowledge.
Well, it's all determined by one's values, and so that if you have Sarah Palin's values, then that the Texas view of history is correct, right? I mean, so that, you know, slavery wasn't so important, or it certainly doesn't say as much about the American character as others of us, you know, believe. And so that's really what I tell my students is that you need to decide what your values are, and then from there you can write your own history based on how you, and I don't want to determine truth for anyone else. I mean, I think that's what people like Sarah Palin do. So, I mean, once you decide what your value is, then I can actually instruct you how to find your own history.
Well, would it be better then to say facts if we're not going to say truth? I mean, facts are facts, aren't they?
I'm not even convinced about that. I mean,
no.
This is an interesting discussion that I love to have, but it's I think there's no fact that cannot be interpreted in more than one way.
Okay.
What I would like to say.
All right, I'll give you that. Well, let's get to the women. Let's get to the bad women.
Sure.
I know whenever Women's History Month rolls around, one of the things we always, women of the world sort of lament is, you know, women have been written out of history. You know, they've been too busy working to write the history books. Their stories aren't there. So that's what attracted me to, part of your work. You're talking about the, not the elite and the rich. You know, you're more like Howard Zinn, you know. I think has anybody ever told you that you're the next Howard Zinn?
Well, it's funny. A colleague of mine just an hour ago said you're the dirty Howard Zinn,
dirty
which I liked
Howard.
A lot, actually.
Now, why did he say that? Why are you the dirty Howard Zinn? Because you talk about what some people call the lowlifes of society.
Yeah, it was actually a she, a female colleague. But yes, yeah, well, so, I mean, the women, the heroes of my book are actually below the social scale, below Howard Zinn's heroes on the social scale. He doesn't mention prostitutes. And by the way, I'm a fan of Howard Zinn's work, and I don't mean to denigrate it. And, you know, it was written...
No, and neither do I. No.
And it was published in 1980, and so, you know, a lot of scholarship has been done, and a lot of things have been discovered since he wrote that. So I don't mean to, but it is a very different approach than his. It sort of begins where he left off, but then looks even further below. So, for instance, he has no prostitutes in his book. He has quite a lot on women, but no prostitutes. And as many people have found out, you know, that prostitution was central, not just to women's lives, but to American lives. From the colonial period onward, but what I argue in my book, I have a chapter on this, is that prostitutes of the 19th century won many of the freedoms that women now take for granted, and that feminists fought for much later, and actually didn't win as readily as prostitutes did.
There's a whole
list of them. Sure.
We'll go into more detail about that, because I don't think my listeners probably know anything about this at all.
Sure. In the 19th century, women, if to be considered respectable, a woman was really not allowed to wear, for instance, makeup. So makeup was only worn by prostitutes in the 19th century. It just simply was not done by any woman who would be considered respectable. So this is lipstick, this is rouge, this is powder. Coloring one's hair was only done by prostitutes. Wearing brightly colored clothes, in particular the color red, was only done by prostitutes. You were really shunned from respectable society if you wore any of those things in the 19th century. The red dress was basically the symbol of prostitution in the 19th century. Now, of course, by the early 20th century, the styles that prostitutes pioneered...
Hello? Well, I think he has disconnected himself. okay, I hope he calls us right back, because it was getting kind of interesting, wasn't it? I'm going to go ahead and put some music on until Thaddeus calls back in. We are not having good luck tonight, are we? Here's Veil of Inanna by Zingaya.
I lift up the jeweled breath.
Okay, I think Thaddeus is back with us now.
That's okay.
I just, put a little music on. So you were talking about the red dress?
Yeah, so by the early 20th century, ordinary working class American women started to adopt the styles that were pioneered by prostitutes. In the first two or three decades of the 20th century, the cosmetics industry quadrupled as sort of ordinary non-prostitute women started to wear lipstick and rouge and powder and started to color their hair. Prostitutes were the first women, basically in American culture, to cut their hair short. The Victorian style was to wear it high and heavy to sort of indicate, you know, which was by many women was seen as a symbol of the weight of motherhood, the responsibility of motherhood. Prostitutes, of course, you know, rejected that notion that women should only be mothers and wives, and so they were the first to cut their hair short. This is well before the flappers did that in the 1920s. But all these styles that prostitutes pioneered became not only respectable, but mainstream, and so that by the 1920s and 1930s, even the first ladies, Eleanor Roosevelt and Lou Henry Hudson wore many of the styles that prostitutes had pioneered in the 19th century. In fact, the official portrait for Eleanor Roosevelt that hangs in the White House shows her wearing a short haircut that was many see as the flapper style was actually the prostitute style of the 19th century. And, of course, the red dress is now the symbol of female respectability. It's what every first lady has worn since Nancy Reagan made it the symbol of the first lady. But all those styles, all those things were pioneered by prostitutes, which I argue, you know, is certainly not, doesn't establish every freedom, but there are other freedoms I haven't gotten to, but it certainly opened the world, made the world larger for American women.
Okay, all right. So
the cosmetics
and...
Yeah, the cosmetics is just the sort of sexiest this, but in terms of economics, there's a clear-cut case. Prostitutes at the lowest levels, I mean, these are the streetwalkers who weren't even in brothels, made on average five times what women in so-called respectable professions like teaching or in the garment industry made. But prostitutes who worked in brothels made often 10 times to 20 times what other women made in respectable positions. And then many of the madams who own those brothels were not only some of the wealthiest women in the United States, they were some of the wealthiest people in the United States, particularly in the West, in cities like Denver and San Francisco and Los Angeles. They owned huge tracts of land and extremely valuable real estate and were some of the most politically powerful people in those cities. This was before women had the votes. But they wielded enormous influence in the politics of those cities and really helped to establish in many ways cities like Los Angeles and San Francisco and Seattle. There was a famous madam in Seattle named Lou Graham who owned a gigantic portion of the city's real estate. In fact, she owned a large portion of the real estate in the entire Pacific Northwest and ended up donating much of her money to various philanthropic causes like hospitals and libraries. And so that Seattle was founded in many ways, and the cultural institutions of Seattle were founded in many ways by a madam, a brothel owner.
Hmm. Well, that wasn't in my history book.
Yeah. Now, again, the context of this is, of course, essential. This is all the 19th century when the law of coverture is the law of the land in all 50 states. The law of coverture meant that in all 50 states, the rights of a woman in a marriage to the property of that couple were nil. So that if you married a man and you somehow gained property in some way, he owned it. He had the legal rights.
So if you inherited it from your family, he still owned it?
Yes. So if you made money from your own business, he owned it. So women had no property rights inside of a marriage. And of course, women who weren't married who weren't prostitutes were generally excluded from most of the high-paying, well, basically all of the high-paying professions. So that it was virtually impossible to be a woman in the United States to be independently wealthy, except for madams. Madams in the United States were the only independently wealthy women. They were the first women in the United States to be independently wealthy and independently politically powerful as well.
So, now forgive me if this sounds like a dumb question, but was it primarily religion that was thwarting women at the time? Was that really what men used to justify, women being so powerless?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's the basis of it. I mean, the law of coverture comes from Old English law, which, of course, itself was rooted in Christianity, biblical injunctions that the woman should be the inferior, subservient member of the couple, et cetera, that she should essentially be the servant to her husband.
Mm-hmm.
That was definitely a large part of the basis for these laws and these cultural norms that place women at the bottom and rendered them powerless, formally powerless, sure.
Okay. So then what happens next? I know you were going to get into immigrant women, but I have a feeling there's probably a little bit more to this story about the prostitutes. Besides what we've already described, bringing, different fashion and that sort of a thing, did they play, more of a role in obtaining, freedoms for today's women that we don't know about?
Yeah, I mean, it was a lot of women, a lot of Americans in general don't know that it was really not okay for women to walk on the street by themselves without a male escort in the 19th century, in the 18th and 19th centuries. It was really, again, So the public sphere idea, the idea that there's a public sphere, that's where men belonged, right? The world of business and politics and just the outdoors, the outside the home, that was where men belonged. And the private sphere was the home, the kitchen, the bedroom, the living room, that's where women belonged. This idea of two spheres grew up in the 19th century, and it was highly gendered. Prostitutes broke it. They broke it open. They were the first to walk in public by themselves without male escort. and do it without shame. And in fact, in Denver and in San Francisco, there were weekly parades of prostitutes up and down the major streets in those cities, and they were sort of flagrant, unabashed, shameless displays. Prostitutes also defended themselves. Many of the madams owned guns and used them. There are many, many stories of prostitutes, especially in the West, who shot men to death who were threatening them. And many sort of streetwalkers were armed and used guns to protect themselves against predatory men or against customers who were violent or against the police even. And again, of course, this was completely taboo, you know, for women to defend themselves, to attack men, to physically defend themselves. Prostitutes were the first to do that.
Let's go back to the parade a minute. I don't want you to get off track, you know, but let's go back to the parade. What was the intention of the parade? Was it that they were just saying, you know, here I am, I'm beautiful, you know, you can have me? Or was it about women's rights?
It was rarely a conscious, explicit, political statement of women's rights, but I argue that it was nonetheless an entirely political act, and that it certainly expanded not formal legal rights, but it expanded cultural freedom for women. No, but I mean, for the most part, these were just advertisements, you know, that were put on by the brothel owners. But that, to me, that's actually less important than the fact that they were simply doing this thing that women were not allowed to do.
Right.
The other thing that prostitutes did, they did many things that women were not allowed to do in the 19th century. They drank in public. That was forbidden for women in the 19th century. They danced in public, completely forbidden. They gambled in public. Women were not allowed to do. They invented most of the dances that became the center of the great dance, the famous dance craze of the 1920s, the jazz age, dances like the Charleston and the Texas Tommy, those were invented by prostitutes in brothels in San Francisco. They were influenced greatly by slaves, but they were the first women to dance those dances in public. So, and of course in the 1920s, that dance craze that was really originated by prostitutes gave rise to the jazz age, which of course laid the basis for rock and roll and rhythm and blues and hip hop and disco and the rest of it. So much of our cultural freedom, much of what we value as Americans now, much of what we cherish and take for granted now was established by people who were considered to be the lowest of the low, the most immoral, the most degraded. Earlier in our history, and that's what we don't know. And prostitutes is just one chapter in the book, but there's many other examples as well.
Well, let me ask you. Before the pill, were the prostitutes potentially, maybe on the cutting edge of birth control for women? Do you cover anything like that?
Thank you for reminding me. Yes, that's a great question. Yes, one of my favorite stories in the book, actually. In 1873, what was called the Comstock Act was passed by Congress, which essentially made birth control illegal. It made it illegal to distribute it. So it was essentially a prohibition on birth control. This was, of course, long before the pill, which was approved by the FDA in 1960.
Using for birth control? What were they prohibiting distribution of?
What we would consider to be primitive forms of condoms and diaphragms. This was before latex is often sheepskin or animal intestines and other forms of vulcanized rubber came in, I think, in the 1880s. It was relatively effective. I mean, I would say it was mostly effective, certainly not as effective as current birth control. But the Comstock Act essentially made birth control illegal. The Comstock Act was the law of the land until the 1920s, so for basically 50 years, birth control was illegal. Now, how did, of course, people continue to use condoms and diaphragms? How did this happen? And this is one of my favorite stories in the book. Jewish immigrants, mostly in New York City, established underground, literally underground, meaning in the basements in their tenements in New York City, in those basements. They established underground illegal condom manufacturing and diaphragm manufacturing factories. And usually it was a family operation, so that they employed their wife and their children in churning out condoms and diaphragms in these basement illegal underground factories. And the ones who were most successful were the ones, it was in Brooklyn and near Times Square. The most successful ones were near Times Square, of course, which had by that time become the red light district of New York City. And so their major customers, of course, were prostitutes. And so if you've ever used a Chic condom or a 4X condom, these were the ones that were actually invented at the time, as they were originally illegal. If you've ever used them, you have unassimilated Jewish immigrants, criminals, basically, and prostitutes to thank for that.
Wow. Wow. That's awesome. I love that story, too. So do the prostitutes get credit for anything else before we continue on with the immigrants?
Yes, there's also employee benefits were really actually pioneered by prostitutes, by brothel owners. In the 19th century, most brothels gave free health insurance.
Huh.
Free health care, not insurance. I mean, they just paid for health care, right? Free birth control, free housing, and free protection. So often, if brothel owners owned guns, they often hired police officers, male police officers, to serve as security guards.
Sounds like they had it better back then than now, unless you're maybe in one of those brothels in Nevada.
Right. Oh, yeah. So that kind of employee benefit package was unheard of in the 19th century. And even now, today, right, it's growing increasingly rare to get those kinds of benefits. I've never found evidence of pension plans, but it's possible that they happened as well. So what happened, though, was that progressives, you know, the progressive movement, and which unfortunately was actually led by feminists, waged a concerted and successful campaign at the turn of the century to make brothels illegal, to shut them down. So there was this, vice commissions were established, led often by feminists in every city in the country. They lobbied the city governments to shut down the brothels, which the city governments did. And, of course, then what happens is the women who worked inside were thrown out into the streets. They no longer had the protection of that domicile. They no longer had the protection of the madam. They no longer had the protection of the police officer who was hired by the madam. They were now prey to violent clients and the police. And who did they turn to for protection? Pimps. That gave rise to male pimps who took over the trade. And
wow.
That's been the case for now a century, because unfortunately, what's one of the great tragedies that people don't know about the history of progressivism and feminism is that progressivism and feminism led the fight for that. They are responsible for making brothels illegal and pushing prostitutes onto the street.
Well, now, tell me why. I mean, why did they even care about that? Why weren't they just worried about getting the vote and rights for women? Why go after the prostitutes?
Well, because they were going for the vote, and they were going for full citizenship. It was precisely what I was talking about with the civil rights movement. It's the same phenomenon, which is we must prove that we are just as good as men, which meant, unfortunately, we are just like men. And sexuality in particular, is always sort of the most dangerous thing to demonstrate if one is operating within the political sphere. That's why politicians are, you know, desperately hide their sexuality so that any hint of any sexuality, even if it's marital, right, is completely taboo. We've never heard one word about what Barack and Michelle do in the bedroom. We never heard anything about what George and Laura did in the bedroom, right? And whenever a politician is outed in any way for any kind of sexual peccadilloes or anything, it's the biggest scandal we can imagine. And so that is precisely what feminists were going for, was a place in the public sphere, literally a place in government through the vote. And so they said this is not me interpreting it, this was what they said, people like Elizabeth Cady Stanton, we must squelch the sexual appetite. We must show ourselves to be, what they said, above those primitive urges. We must show ourselves to be of the people of a rational mind, so that we can prove that we are worthy of the place of office, a political office.
Wow.
And so that was really, unfortunately, the fight for suffrage was in many ways primarily responsible for the attack on the brothel, which was a source of immense women's power.
Wow. You know, wow. that's an incredible story, and I had no idea, and I wonder how many feminists even know that. What a shame. What a shame.
Well, no, I will say just quickly, this is much of this history I did not, you know, find myself. All of this was written by feminist historians. So I do recommend to your listeners, in particular, a wonderful book by Ruth Rosen, which is called The Lost Sisterhood, which was really the first scholarly history of prostitution, and I think still the best, but there have been many since then as well. Timothy Guilfoyle's City of Eros is another one I would recommend. And you'll find the stories I've been telling you in those books.
Okay. Well, we have probably about 10 minutes left, so let's dedicate that to the immigrant women. How
sure.
did they liberate us?
Well, if you were an average American living in the middle of the 19th century, even in the city, most Americans lived in the country. The vast majority of Americans until the 20th century lived in rural areas, lived on farms. That meant, of course, you had to grow your own food. You know, you had to make your own clothes. It's most likely you never left a 50-mile radius from your farm. You purchased nothing that was produced from outside of your immediate area. You didn't go to the movies because they didn't exist. You didn't drive a car because it didn't exist. You didn't go to Nickelodeons; they didn't exist. You didn't go to Coney Island because it didn't exist. You didn't shop at super department stores; they didn't exist. Now, all of those things came of age, were basically invented and developed and became popular right around the turn of the century, which is what historians now call the consumer revolution, which was part of the industrial revolution. Kind of all the good stuff that came out of capitalist development, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what other historians have shown and what I sort of all put together into one package in one chapter is the argument that the consumer revolution, the consumer part of that industrial revolution, was driven primarily by young, poor, working-class immigrant women in New York, Boston, Philadelphia, Chicago, and other cities like that. They were the most aggressive consumers of things like the movies, of amusement parks, of dime novels, of fashion. The idea that you could dress in a way that was not just utilitarian, that made you look good and made you look stylish, that was a new idea, by the way. It was not okay in American culture to dress in a stylish, fashionable way. That was seen as being effeminate in a bad way. It was seen as being European until the turn of the 20th century. This whole generation of largely Jewish and Italian and some Irish women who had just come to the country brought with them this idea that it was not only okay but a wonderful thing to dress to make yourself look beautiful, to make yourself look stylish, to wear bright colors, etc. And they loved to dance. The dance craze was invented by them, and the idea of nightclubs were developed because they had this new consumer base that was mostly female and mostly young and mostly immigrant, mostly poor. Again and again and again, historians have found examples of things like that were pioneered, that were driven by a hungry female population who wanted those pleasures that were forbidden in Victorian and Puritan America. And so they're the real heroes. And so what I say is against all the odds, they have invented American fun.
Hmm. Well, Thaddeus, I have to ask you, do you get many invitations to talk for Women's History Month? Because I think you have a lot of interesting stuff to say I don't think most women hear about.
I would love to, sure. It's some of my favorite stuff in the book, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is, you know, this has really been interesting. I've really enjoyed this, and I think I'm going to have your book in my library if for nothing else a reference, because you've flung open the doors tonight on some ideas I hadn't even thought of. So thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, great. Thank you. And you're welcome.
Where can people get your book? All the regular places?
All the regular places. It's on Amazon.com, and it's in pretty much every, should be in every good independent bookstore, and it's at Barnes & Noble and Borders, and it's not hard
to
find.
Well, I'm sure you've probably already thought of it yourself, but, you know, when Women's History Month does roll around, I hope maybe you'll write some of these articles or take some excerpts from some of your chapters and put it on some of your online columns, because I think women would really enjoy reading this and it would really open their eyes.
That's a very good idea, actually, yes, yes.
Yep.
I will. I will do that.
Well, listen, thank you so very much for being a part of the show and for teaching myself and my listeners so much tonight. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, good night.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Well, if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss goddess, the divine feminine, the resurging interest in right brain thinking and the feminine consciousness, whether the great she be deity, archetype, or ideal, and how these new values and benchmarks just can save the world. And you've been listening to Thaddeus Russell, author of The Renegade History, as he enlightened us on the contributions of the unsung heroines of early American history, namely the poor immigrants and the early prostitutes in our country. Who would have thought they gave us so much and contributed so much? Really, really, really very eye-opening. But now we're going to turn our attention to our next guest, and I see Art is on the switchboard waiting for me to unmute him, which I will do in 2 seconds here. But let me go ahead and read Art's bio for you listeners so you have a little bit of background on him before we start our chat, which I know is going to be really interesting. He and I have already started a chat on Facebook earlier today, so I know this is going to be fun. Art Noble is the author of The Sacred Female, A Sonata of Sexual Love and Spirituality. Art says he is blessed by having known some fantastic women, and he is cursed with curiosity. This novel of his, it's not a nonfiction book, it is a novel, The Sacred Female, is based on experience and research into modern and ancient human sexuality and love. He was born in L.A., grew up in Key West, where he lived 4 years in the Hemingway home. I'm sure that was inspirational. He's the son of internationally known artist Van Noble, who opened the Hemingway home as an art gallery before it became a museum. And on moving, he acquired a lamp from the home, and he still writes under that lamp. That's a nice story. So let me say hello to Art. Hi, Art. You with us?
Oh, I sure am. Golly, that Thaddeus Russell is fantastic. Fascinating, isn't he?
I wanted to ask him
some questions.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
I thought you were just there waiting in the wings for me to get to you. I didn't know you had a question.
Well,
you know what? I can put you in touch with him, and you guys can
please chat. Oh, I'd love that. He's fascinating.
Yeah, you know, I was calling him the, the next Howard Zinn, and he said, that's interesting. He said a woman friend of his just told him today he wasn't the new Howard Zinn. He was the new dirty version of Howard Zinn.
Yeah, I heard the show. And the thing, and that stuck with me, because whenever we hear the word sex, we think dirty, and that has got to change.
Well,
you know,
you're right, on the one hand, I mean, I think I'm probably one of the most liberal-minded people there is, but I have to say, even I thought to myself, you know, here I'm going to have a sex conversation tonight with a guy. Why am I having it with a guy, and why am I not having it with a woman? You know, but maybe, you know what, I think it's 100 times better that I'm having it with a guy, because you prove to women and men out there that, that men are interested in this stuff, and men are enlightened, and we can get beyond the blow-up dolls.
Yeah, Thank heavens. Well, there's a lot of there's quite a few of us out there, yes, who have gone beyond the blow up doll stage.
Oh, I know. I was just making a joke there, but
it still exists, and that's what I'm trying to overcome, and I've got reasons for it. We talk on your show thing, and we might as well get this out of the way right away. The last thing you say is, and I'll take it first, is where female orgasmic ejaculation is found in the Bible.
Okay.
Now, first of all, female ejaculation is just, wow, it's brand new, you know? I mean, everybody's talking or whispering about it, you know, does she, you know, I wonder, you know. And here's the thing. In Leviticus 12:2, in the King James Version, it says, when a woman conceives a seed and bears a child. In the Hebrew translation from the Torah, it says, when a woman has an emission and bears a male child. Oh, now, what happens, you have to understand, Leviticus was, 1425 B.C. See, Thaddeus has got all this modern stuff, and I've got all this ancient stuff.
Yeah, y'all are great bookends, huh?
Yeah, but it was probably, you know, women were ejaculating probably for 1,000 years before Moses.
Well, we
and
hope so.
And the belief was that it took both female ejaculate and male ejaculate, that each one of these two things were required for conception to take place. Now, 400 is when the Torah was written, most scholars think it was put on paper, because prior to that it had been oral tradition. So it was put on papyrus, let's say, around the year 400 B.C. Now, some scholars think it may have been put on papyrus around 1000 B.C. when Solomon's Temple was built. But anyway, 400 B.C. is considered the date. So what happens is, this is the same time that Hippocrates is running around in Greece. And there was a lot of trade and going back and forth. So, it's easy for me to imagine some Jewish fella getting off the boat and going to a nearby tavern for a quick one and running into Hippocrates there. And, you know, two guys get together. What do they talk about? Girls, right?
Right.
And so Hippocrates scratching his head, and the Jewish fella tells him, hey, it's easy. They come, we come, and they get a baby. From that, Hippocrates came up with what was later known as the double seed theory of conception. Okay.
So the double seed was the male and female ejaculating, and if the woman didn't ejaculate, she could become pregnant? Is that what they thought?
That's right. You had to ejaculate, he said that a woman carried a seed and a man carried a seed in his ejaculate, and those two seeds got together to form the child. So they were referred to as seeds. Now, this was confirmed by Galen in 200 A.D., you know, the great physician of that time, Greco-Roman, but he had a slightly different take on the purpose of the fluid. But the double seed was okay. So when the Roman Church came along, 325, they started promoting it. And they promoted it up until at least 1660, when Leeuwenhoek looked through the microscope and could find male sperm but couldn't find any female seed. Okay?
Right.
So, they figured, well, you know, women are inferior, so maybe their seed is smaller. They didn't know that the female egg was 150 times the size of the sperm. Okay?
Okay.
Now, anyway, they go on, and then some Dutch scientist in 1770, some Dutch scientist artificially inseminates a water spaniel, and whoosh, that was it, boy. No more female ejaculation. Because this is about 8 to 10, from what I've been told, it's 8 to 10 times more pleasurable than a woman having a climax or orgasm if she ejaculates along with it.
So what you're saying is, every time a woman has an orgasm, she doesn't always ejaculate.
And same with men. I've had numerous non-ejaculatory orgasms. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
That's we can do this. We have this. For me, it wasn't a matter of power. It just happened, you know.
Mm-hmm.
What's that? Oh, that's a nice, you know. But and, of course, the nice thing is there's no recovery period. There's no loss. But
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
So anyway, the point is that here we have female orgasmic ejaculation in the Bible as requirement. Now, I have a blog on my website, www.thesacredfemale.com. Well, the blog's not there. It's on Women's Radio. But there's a link to it. Okay, and you can go to my website and click on that link and read all about it. And it's a little more in detail than I've given you here. But, yeah, that was the first thing. Now, the next thing is, around this time of Hippocrates, and we got Aristotle, women had been, you know, they've always been, since the dawn of civilization. And he's talking about the rite of coverture. That goes back a long time before British law, English law. It was back during the Greeks, too. But anyway, the thing is that women had very few rights, and they were kept getting put down and put down, yet they still had some power. And that power, you know, it's sexual power, but it gradually got eaten away, eroded away. And the big thing was when Aristotle came along, he said that men were this proved men were superior to women because their ejaculate was thicker. Women's ejaculate was thinner. Therefore, they had less of the element fire. Well, he was wrong on two counts. I've got an archived show on female sexual anatomy showing 16 different places in the female genitalia that are specifically known for pleasure spots, but pleasure is just a reflection of how much electrochemical energy is generated. But anyway, and men, of course, only have six, so he was wrong there. And secondly, he should have known that a fluid loses viscosity when it's heated. Therefore, a woman must have had more fire because their fluid was thinner.
Okay, that makes total sense.
Like honey.
All right.
You know, you heat up honey, right, and it gets thin. Same thing. So, but that's why men are superiors, because our ejaculate was thicker and we had
thicker.
More of the element fire. Yeah.
Sounds
so
pretty flimsy to me.
Oh, yeah, today it does, but then it was good. I mean, like I said, for 3,000 or 4,000 years, the belief system was that a woman had to ejaculate in order for a child to be conceived. And this was just common knowledge. Everybody knew that. Okay?
Okay.
But, so when they found out that wasn't true, it got shut down. But women
and maybe I got this wrong. Maybe for the last 50 years of my life, you know, I don't know what's happening with my own body. But, you know, I'm thinking to myself, okay, I'm connecting ejaculation with orgasm. That might be my mistake. But I'm thinking about the women who get pregnant from rape. They didn't have an orgasm. But we're not connecting ejaculation with orgasm. Because you said that a minute ago, and I'm still trying to wrap my brain around it. You can ejaculate without. It's not the orgasm that causes the ejaculation.
They're two different phenomenon. Both. What's the word I'm looking for? Triggered by the same stimulus, okay? But they are different phenomenon.
Okay, they're triggered by
sexual activity.
It's just the activity, not necessarily pleasurable activity.
One woman has told me that she was raped and she had an orgasm.
Okay. All right.
Okay,
well,
so there. The point is that we all women, and this is the big lesson that I have learned. All women respond differently. In my talks on female sexual anatomy, I point out that, you know, this is the way women are hardwired. You got these structures are attached to these nerve groups. There are four basic nerve groups that service the sexual structures there in the genitalia. And this is the way they're attached, and you stimulate that one. But I didn't hardwire them, okay? I'm telling you what it looks like, but that's not the way it works. And it you know, like, I'm an engineer. And I have a degree in engineering, and I'm used to, you know, you wire a light switch to a light, and when you turn the light switch on, that light's supposed to go on.
Right.
Well, with a woman, sometimes it does, and sometimes it doesn't.
Well, and
sometimes the whole damn house lights up, you know.
and you haven't flipped any switch.
Yeah.
Well, you know, when I'm sitting here thinking about, you know, a lot of the documentaries I've seen about,
yeah,
you know, women trying to reclaim their sexuality, and how many women don't even know what they look like down in their genital area. You know, I mean, so many women are so disconnected, so we certainly don't really know the scientific aspects of it, the mechanics of it. You know, I doubt many of us take the time to read about some of the things you were just talking about.
Yeah, I have on my website a link to a radio show on female sexual anatomy for guys. Well, girls can listen to it too. You know, it's good for them. And I have a diagram that can be printed out. Okay.
Okay.
On that site. So they can go and look at it and follow the diagram and see how the nerves hook up, because the female genitalia is a power plant. It is a power plant. Now, here's something I think we should do. I should have done this earlier. And that is to give you a clinical definition of sex. Okay?
Okay.
Sex is the mental and or physical stimulation of nerve ends, creating electrochemical energy, resulting in pleasurable sensations in the genitalia and other sexual responses. And it's the other sexual responses that I'm really interested in. See, everybody looks at the function of sex as to generate pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that pleasure is nothing more than a reflection of the amount, the quantity of electrochemical energy that we allow to be generated.
Okay.
Now, I say allow because both men and women, okay, we're very much alike in a lot of ways. Our minds, that is, are the collection of our beliefs and our experiences and all that, control our brains. All right?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Now, our body reacts not only to the stimulus, but also to what the mind is telling the brain to react to. For example, if a woman is told from childhood on that sex is dirty, pleasure is wrong, and we are to deprive ourselves of pleasure in order to be spiritual,
mm-hmm,
and she believes that, she's never going to have an orgasm, even though the female ejaculatory orgasm is in the Bible.
Right.
If they are of a fundamental belief, well, hey, it's going to, you know, weigh on them.
Right.
What I'm trying to do with my work is to go back and trace where all of these myths and this misinformation came from. Point, you know, it's like they do in ACOA. You face, trace, erase, and replace. You face the problem. You trace it back to its source. You erase it, and then you replace it with better information.
Okay, I like that.
That was their process. And, yeah, it's a good process. It works. But the thing is that we got to get this information out, and I've only got a small amount. Now, the next big thing was that women got really hung up period and burned at the stake with the Malus Maleficarum,
right,
which was a 1486 document. You're familiar with that?
Yeah. I mean, that's what they used to, you know, to determine if somebody was a witch, and, you know, it was like
right,
their guidebook.
Well, yeah, and women were already dead. I mean, you know, they said in there that women, all women, were agents of the devil, and it was that woman's insatiable, there was man's lust, which is insatiable in women, that was the cause of all evil and witchcraft.
Okay.
In the world. Okay. So a woman, you know, she had three strikes against her before she went to trial, simply because
yeah.
she was a woman. Now, this was a scam, though. You see, earlier, 1470s or early 1480s, Ferdinand and Isabel in Spain started to purify the country and make it all Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were looking for heretics, heresy. And many Jews had converted from Judaism to Catholicism in order to be assimilated into the community. At
right.
least it was an outward conversion. Then,
right.
They'd celebrate Shabbat on Friday and go to Mass on Sunday. Well, mm-hmm. if they got caught celebrating the Mass after Ferdinand and Izzy came up with this decree,
they could be
heretics.
Burned at the stake, too, along with the witches.
But that wasn't the big deal. The big deal was, or what the real prize was here, was not making Spain Catholic. Their property was confiscated and went into the coffer of the king.
Yeah, it became a cottage industry, the Inquisition, just a means
right.
to steal from people.
Yeah. It was a legal confiscation. Well, the church did the same thing
yeah.
with the Malus Maleficarum, only... They let Spain go ahead and do that thing, but they took over the rest of the world with this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay? And Russia has the highest incidence of men being burned at the stake.
Really?
Only 80% there were women and 20% men. But
so
the rest
did they
of the
burn
world,
men at the stake because they either thought
oh, yeah.
they were witches or they were
oh,
heretics?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Sure. But there, according to one report I read, there was a total of 9 million people prosecuted or died because of being prosecuted for witchcraft. And do you know when the last successful prosecution for witchcraft took place?
Probably here in the United States, huh?
Nope, close.
Not in Salem? No, in England?
Nope.
Okay.
Wait a second, 1944.
44?
1944 was the last successful prosecution for witchcraft
wow.
in England. Yeah.
Wow.
So this whole thing has been going on for a long time. Now, getting back to the definition of sex, okay, we look at what goes on in the human body. This electrochemical energy, actually it's just ions. And what happens is that as the various erogenous areas are being stimulated, the nerve ends are producing this electrochemical energy. Now, there's a
You're
group of
cells...
You're
taking the romance out of it, Art, but go ahead.
I know it. I want to do that right now. Yeah, because when you understand what's going on, you will see how much far more romantic it can be.
Okay.
And powerful.
Okay,
What's going on is that the on the posterior wall of the vagina, there's a group of cells called the interstitial cells of Kegel. Now, these cells have been found, they were first found near the heart and are called pacemaker cells, and they produce the calcium ions. Well, we know that in sex, calcium ions are the ones that trigger the genes on about a half a dozen chromosomes to produce our favorite neurotransmitter and receptor, dopamine, right?
Ah, okay, good old dopamine.
Yeah, now, and of course there are at least, I know of 16, probably hundreds of other places. They're also producing various ions that are impacting the genes that are producing hormones and enzymes and neurotransmitters, like hormones like oxytocin, serotonin, and just a whole bunch of other stuff. It's an electrochemical or biochemical
alchemy.
Factor. It's not alchemy, it's real. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
It's hardcore microbiology.
Okay.
Unfortunately, microbiology only goes so far, along with our knowledge of genetics. Our knowledge of genetics in the human genome at this time, I would say, is comparable to Amerigo Vespucci's map of the New World in 1507.
Okay.
We don't know that much. Now, in our chromosomes, there are, you know, that the DNA is composed of base pair, and that a gene is nothing but a segment, a sequence of base pair, okay, that operates in a certain fashion. Now, there are 3.1 billion base pair. And the genes that we know about today, either 20 or 30,000, they're still arguing over that, they only occupy 90 million base pair. So that leaves 3.01 billion base pair unaccounted for.
That's a lot of stuff. Are we getting back to the orgasm soon?
Soon, yes. Okay, no, we're going beyond orgasm. We're going beyond orgasm. Now, as I said, as you said, I've known some fantastic women, and one of the things that happened is I fell in love. I mean, really deeply, totally, unconditionally in love. And when I was in love, I figured that God could do a lot better job of loving than I could, so I just opened myself up and imagined that God was loving her through me.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah. And, you got to let the boss do his job. it took me out of the picture. It was one of those times when I was egoless. But anyway, getting back to our DNA, is that when we are making love as opposed to having sex, I mean, when we're having sex, yeah, and we're doing it for pleasure, yeah, and it's great, yeah, and we're triggering a lot of this stuff, but something else is happening when we're in love. Something else is happening when we let go and let God do it, as it were. I don't know. Now, here, I don't know. I'm speculating. I am speculating that either we are triggering other known genes, or perhaps we are creating genes. I don't know. But something is happening that is making us different people. Our brains work better. We become more aware. We become more intuitive. I mean, Napoleon Hill, in his book, Think and Grow Rich, okay? I'm talking to guys. I know you've got a lot of lady listeners, but I'm talking to guys. He has a whole chapter devoted to the mystery of sex. And he interviewed the 500 of the wealthiest men in America between 1913 and 1935. And he wrote a whole chapter on the mystery of sex. And he said in there that his observation was that the combination of love, sex, and romance can raise a man from mediocrity to the altitude of genius.
So maybe that's where that idea behind every successful man is a good woman.
We just didn't
know what they were really talking about, right?
Yeah. Now, the problem is that a lot of people don't like this. They don't like
what? Like, this,
oh, they
this,
don't want men to get smart.
Well,
no.
Why...
They
well, we
want
don't want them to stay, drowning in their testosterone in front of the television watching hockey all day either.
No, what I'm talking about, well, the bankers do because they go to work and then they pay their bills.
Okay.
You know, then they come home and then they sit in front of the TV, but they go to work first. You know, that's the whole thing. The problem is once you have been. In Tantra, they call this divine enlightenment. And I'm sure that in the sex of the tarot and shamanic sex, there are words for this. And the common phrase is transcendent sex, when you just transcend your own body and the experience is magnificent, but it has nothing to do with what we consider sexual pleasure. I mean, if you think that having an orgasm is the end of it, no. It's just the beginning.
So, Art, okay, I'm trying to put all the pieces together because we're sort of like all over the place. So,
yeah.
Are you saying that, all right, when we go beyond just the, you know, the sexual act, when we include the romance, when we include the love, then it, in like the Think and Grow Rich book, that's when man becomes, and I'm using, you know, man as a, you know, just not necessarily gender,
right.
Man or woman, that's when they, you know, they become enlightened, they become elevated. It's like when it gets beyond just pleasure or a sexual act, you know, just sort of,
right.
You know, hitting it, then they get to a point where it is, you're using the word transcendent, I'll use the word enlightened. I'm making the next step to, it's almost liberating, and then like you're not a slave anymore. You're sort of in a whole different headspace about life in general. Or am I going too far with this?
Oh, no. No, you're not going far enough.
Okay. All right, so take the rest of the way.
At the time, in the experience, you're not even a part of it. In my experience, now, Dr. Jenny Wade has broken down. Excuse me just a second. I'm terribly sorry.
That's okay.
Dr. Jenny Wade has categorized 13 different varieties of transcendent sex, and I have experienced 3 in sex. And one of these is called deity presence. Another, the 3 that I experienced are deity presence, merging, and transport. Okay.
All right. So tell us what each of those are.
Okay. It was like being in the presence of God, and God was smiling.
So is that where we
That's
get this idea
feeling.
From, you know, in the past, men used to think it was through, you know, intercourse or, you know, having sex with women that they could reach God. You know, I'm assuming that's where, you know, that's exactly
yes.
the same thing. Back when sexuality was revered and not taboo and, you know, this was all something we aimed for instead of we're told to feel guilty about.
Right. This is pre-civilization.
Well, I don't know about pre-civilization, probably pre-Christianity.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, because
the pagans,
you know, the pagans had their Aphrodite temples and the sacred prostitution, and, you know, that all got demonized because, heaven forbid, we couldn't reach God through woman. We had to reach God through a priest.
Right,
you know?
And pay him. Well, just like
yeah.
we had to pay the women, too. But the point that I would make there is that the women were identified with a god, you know, Aphrodite or Apollo or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so when a man went to a sacred prostitute, he went to her with an attitude of awe and reverence.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
okay.
if the dummy had done the same thing at home with his wife, he'd have got the same results. You know, really, that's the bottom line, is that we need to focus more on giving and receiving love during our sexual experience than we need to focus on giving and receiving pleasure.
So you're one of these guys that doesn't mind spooning and don't mind talking and holding one another afterwards, because that's all part of the love. That's all part of the package.
Oh yeah.
You see, we need more men like this, Art.
Well, I don't know. I think some people think one of me's enough. But anyway, the whole thing is that we're being misdirected, and we're being told that sex is love, and it ain't.
Right. Well, I think most women could tell you that. It's just, you know, the poor guys, they've been led astray.
Yeah, the guys too. But the young'uns, they still think that sex is love. I mean, I'm talking high school ones.
Yeah, you're probably right.
And you know, these are the kids. These are the people that I'm trying to reach to give them some, you know, I tell you, like, I'm speculating on what happens in our DNA to make us smarter, quote. But that's speculation, and I recognize that. I don't know. That's not a fact or a truth. But something sure happens, and that's the only place I can see it happening. But that I don't know everything, you know. But
well, I mean,
we have...
how do you see? I mean, as a guy who has reached this point, and you know, I don't think I'm going out on a limb. I'd put money on you're in the minority rather than the majority of men who, you know, have come to this point where, you know, if you honor and revere your, you know, your wife and treat her like a queen, well, you know, life will be good at home, and you know, maybe we can reach God together. But I mean. Have you given thought as to what we can do to sort of change this message in society? I mean, we have all this pornography. We have, look, I'm a fan of Hollywood. They do good things, but they also do bad things. And, you know, just our whole patriarchal culture that, you know, determines what beauty is, determines what sexuality is. I mean, it's all warped. You know, it doesn't resemble reality. I mean, we talk a lot about how everything that is unnatural we accept as normal. And
yeah.
I don't know, have you given thought to how we shift things?
I am a teacher. I'm a former college professor. And I think that education is going to help. And this is why my shows, a lot of them, I try to make very educational, that one on female sexual anatomy. It's only a half-hour show, but people are going to be blown away. The same one on the one that I did where I speculate, oh, here's another little thing. Nahmanides in the 13th century, late 1200s, a Jewish mystic in Spain wrote, the Holy Letter. Now, this is a marriage manual for the Kabbalah, really.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes in, he's got a lot of stuff in there. Some of it's bull hockey, but some of it's pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And the most important thing that he has in there, as far as I am concerned, is that you treat the woman, her genitalia, and the act with an attitude of reverence. The same way a guy would have gone into the sacred prostitutes.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
just, you know, this is, and the purpose of this marriage manual is to produce learned sons.
Well, you know, I'm thinking, you know, you hear that, you know, men used to, you know, bring their sons to prostitutes to learn about sex. And, you know, you wonder if that wasn't such a bad idea. You know, at first maybe our mores cringe a little bit, but maybe if it was the right caliber under the right circumstances, if it was what we call herodules, I think that's how you pronounce the word. I've seen it written but never actually heard it spoken. You know, the modern-day sacred prostitute, that, you know, that may go a long way to teaching men this reverence and this love so that they don't confuse having sex with, you know, the act of lovemaking.
I don't
know. No, you don't
disagree? I thought about that. I thought about that. But I had one of these social sites. I had a friend who was a prostitute, is a prostitute in England. And I was teaching her stuff. I was teaching her stuff. And we need better education. I mean, most women, that not only their external genitalia, they don't know a thing about their internal genitalia. If you go to a doctor, an OBGYN, they don't know that much about the female prostate. They still call it non-functioning paraurethral glands. And,
well, you know, I think there's something to be said for, I mean, you're an engineer, so I understand you think that way. But I'm also thinking, remember I was kidding you before, I said, you know, Art, you're taking the romance out of it. I don't know that I want to know too much. You know, I don't want to, you know, be able to know what I look like on the inside exactly. I'd be seeing a chart on my, a chart in my third eye, in my mind, you know, when I'm laying lying in bed or something, you know, it would sort of
okay.
take the magic out of it. But
but
at least that would be a roadmap. That would be a start. But I think part of the problem is we have all of this, you know, pent up, you know, repression, you know, thanks to patriarchal religion, you know, that
right.
sort of just made all of this taboo and demonized the woman and demonized sex. It's almost, what was that expression you used before? It's almost as if we have to erase all of that.
Right.
You know.
Well, we got to find out where it came from first.
Yeah.
And that I have another radio show on sexual myth and misogyny. See, women, humans, to start with, are, you know, we have been raised for the past couple of thousand years in this attitude of shame. We are sinners. We're poor
mm-hmm.
creatures. And we are fantastic. Human beings are fantastic creatures. I wanted to mention this. We were talking about the power. You're hearing all this stuff on TV now about ancient astronauts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it must have been an ancient astronaut because man couldn't do this. I'm saying bull hockey. Man can do this. I have no doubt of the capacity of our brains to create systems that could lift those huge blocks of the pyramids. And have you heard of the Antikythera machine? That
no.
machine they found, well, it's a name for an island in Greece that they found it off of. They don't know what the heck it does. It is a fabulous machine, and they can't figure out what it was for. Today, we don't have the technical capacity to figure out what this ancient machine is for. Oh, it must have been built by an astronaut. Horse feathers. We men, mankind, with the power that we can get from with the love of a woman and loving that woman. That's power, real power.
So it sounds like to me, Art, it's almost like you're saying the love of a woman is the catalyst for,
yes.
for a man to succeed in the world, for a man to be inspired, for a man to be great. Am I hearing you right?
Works both ways. Not only the love of a woman, but his love for her too. It's
mm-hmm.
not one-sided. It's not
mm-hmm.
a one-sided thing at all. It has to be mutual.
Well, you know, I'm getting this picture of Kali standing on top of Shiva. You know how you usually see that picture
uh-huh.
where he's laying there flat, and she's standing on top of him. And in feminist theology, what we talk about is, you know, she activates him. Until she activates him, he really can't do anything. In a way, you're talking about the same thing.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. I'm not that from. Kali to me was the slayer, and what she slayed was our egos.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's
okay,
part
so
of it.
Yeah, and I think that the ego resides in the corpus callosum.
and what's the corpus callosum?
That's the connection between the left and right half of the brain.
okay. Well, now tell me a little bit more about the sexual myth and misogyny. Where did you want to go with that?
Well, the concept is that misogyny leads to this sexual myth and vice versa. Example was the Malus Maleficarum.
Okay.
Now, then after they discovered, after the artificial insemination of the water spaniel in 1770, by the early 1800s, authoritative papers were coming out that said women didn't have any sex drive, and they were simply there for men's pleasure, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go through the 19th century, come towards the end, and you have Kraft Ebbing saying that, female ejaculation is a lesbian condition because only men ejaculate. And then Freud in 1905 said, a woman looks upon a mucous vaginal discharge as disgusting during sex. And first of all, the discharge from the vagina of an orgasmic vaginal discharge is clear and copious. The mucus discharge comes from the prostate, is formed in the prostate and comes out through the urethra. Okay? So mm-hmm. Freud didn't know what he was talking about.
He didn't know what he talked about a lot of things, but, you know.
he really ticks me off, and it ticks me off that so many people listen to him.
Well, you know, and what you're reminding me of when you're talking about these, you know, these discharges, I wrote a book, Sacred Places of Goddess, so I was, researching, all different sacred sites around the world, and in southern India, there are these groups that, you know, revere the female, and one of the things they do as part of their rituals is that discharge, that vaginal fluid, that's coveted, you know?
Oh, yeah.
But that stuff, you know, it's hard to talk about in polite conversation or over the dinner table, you know.
And why? Why is that?
Because of our Judeo-Christian baggage.
Go back
further.
Religion is just a transport, a carrier for it. The problem is that, as I say, all of these things that we're talking about, all of these sexual responses, and we've touched on them, they are energy builders, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, we not only create energy, but somehow it is synergistically transferred, okay? I mean, women, like I said, women have 16 points, men have 6, and so women are far greater energy producers, and
almost
somehow,
3 times as much. So,
yeah.
What do you do with that energy, though? I mean, how?
This is what happens. I think this is what makes new genes, you might say, or activates a new combination of genes that empowers our brain to work more effectively. You know, I'm looking at it strictly physically. That's how we get raised from the from mediocrity to the altitude of genius. But
so without a healthy sex life, you're screwed.
Yeah, right. Right. Without a good woman in your life, it's not just sex. It's a healthy love life.
No, I know what you're saying. No,
yeah.
I totally get that. I totally get that. And I know there are women out there saying, oh, where can I find somebody like Art, you know, because it's not often we hear this kind of thing from guys. You know, I'm sure a lot of women have written off the idea that, there are even guys out there like you, Art.
Well, there are. And there's guys out there that are scratching their heads because, you know, how you always hear women saying, is this all there is?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, guess what? There's a lot of guys saying it, too.
Right.
And I'm
no,
telling
I'm
you,
sure.
No, you're right. This isn't all there is. There's so much more. Now, we've talked about orgasmic vaginal discharge, which is a... Now, you see, here's the thing. Dr. Whipple and I disagree. She says that, and this comes from Grafenberg, who said that there could sometimes be a very copious flow from the urethra, okay? He's saying all of this stuff comes from the urethra. No. Ejaculate comes from the urethra, and I believe that the vaginal discharge is just that, a vaginal discharge, for a number of reasons, but primarily because the flow rate is too great to come through a quarter-inch orifice. Remember, I'm an engineer. I look at things that way.
Mm-hmm, right.
But the point is that those are two, in my book, two different responses. However, most women ejaculate at the same time they're having the orgasmic vaginal discharge. So when they analyze the fluid, the prostatic-specific antigen that comes from the urethra, from the ejaculate, from the prostate, is mixed in with the vaginal discharge. So they say, well, it all came from the urethra.
Right, right. Well, and I think that's why it's easy to confuse the ejaculation, to not see them as being the same thing, the ejaculation and the orgasm together.
Yeah, they are two separate events that occur usually at the same time.
Right, right. Well, Art, we probably got about 10 minutes here, so I want to make sure, because I know we've sort of been all over the place and I've interrupted you a lot. Have we missed any important points you want to make sure we hit on before we have to close the show? Because we got like about 10 minutes left.
Okay, that one last thing is that in transcendent sex, another one of the things that Jenny Wade talks about, and I didn't know about this until I read it in her book, was trespasso. Now, this is when a different head or a succession of heads or even an animal head can appear on your lover.
A head? Wait, I'm
a head. In other
me.
Words, instead of looking at your lover's face and head,
You're seeing somebody else.
Somebody else's, and maybe a whole different string of them. And they may not even be people you know. Or you could see the head of an animal. And most common are the bird, the bear, and the wolf.
Okay.
Now, here's the kicker. Gobi, you've done a lot of archaeological research and historic research, and I'm sure that you have seen animal-headed figures of men on frescoes, on carvings, and so on.
Sure,
right?
Just look at the Egyptians or
exactly.
Native Americans or whatever.
Totems.
Right, totems.
Guess where they came from? Nanny, nanny, boo, boo.
So you think
sure.
these were visions seen during this transcendent sex?
Right.
Interesting.
Yeah, but the problem is that archaeologists don't know that much about sex. Sexual response, they don't even look at it. See, that's why I put out that clinical definition. They don't even look at it clinically because they've been conditioned through their religious background probably or social background. Oh, that's dirty. We don't talk about that. But if you look at it clinically, you can see things more clearly. And if you've had the experience, as I have had, it makes, you know, I can look at things. Have you seen, are you familiar with the double spiral on the bellies of these ancient statues? They have a vulva and above it is a double spiral?
I think I know what you're talking about. It's like the spiral that's sort of almost like a little labyrinth or something. Is that what you're talking about?
Yep. And they're in this hemisphere, it's usually a spiral on either side. You know, it's one spiral here and one spiral there. But in the Greek and Middle Eastern and Egyptian, it's the double spiral is right generally above the vulva. And most archaeologists say, oh, this is symbolic of the vulva. And I'm saying, no.
So what do you think, Art?
Oh, it's symbolic of our DNA. You see, these artisans who had this experience know that it comes from within. They didn't know how far within. They didn't have to know how far within. Okay? And they knew that it came from something that looked like this. And where we show a nice, pretty, twisted ladder, okay, in reality, those chromosomes are all scrunched up almost as a spiral, and the DNA within them is, you know, not as pretty as a double helix as we see in our diagrams.
Right.
And so they have just as much right to call that representative of DNA as we do the double helix representation of DNA.
Well, I think, you would, it's a shame Maria Gimbutas is not still alive. You know, she was one of the archaeologists who was brave enough to take the next leap and, you know, draw conclusions that a lot of, the archaeologists we have today, I mean, they just have a hard time connecting the dots because if they don't know what, they're not going to use their intuition, you know. So if in some of these things, well, you know, you can't discover these things from digging in a trash heap of history, you know.
Unless you know what's going on. I mean, Rhianne Eisler, I love her work. I just love it. And to me, it is so frustrating because she is so close. She is so close. I just want to push her over the edge, you know, to get her there.
Elaborate on that quickly, because, you know, she's a favorite of ours here on the show. What's the next step she needs to take in her vision?
I think, she's looking at partnership, which is great, okay?
Right.
And I go further than that. I'm calling it, it's more a melding through love, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But why would a guy want to do that? I mean, we've got these big egos, you understand, because we're males and we're superior. And this is the way we've been taught for 2,000 to 5,000 years. Not only that, if you look, go back and look at the Spartans and the early Romans, in combat they were penetrators. They formed a wall of shields, and they penetrated the enemy with sword and spear from behind that shield.
Right.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Men, and they carried that philosophy into the bedroom.
Right,
we don't
the penetration,
share,
the weapon, yeah.
Right, and from behind a shield, because we do not share generally with our wives. There is no intimate talk with our wives. We don't know how they feel or what really turns them on. We don't care. We're getting our rocks off, you know, bottom
so
line.
You're
and
you're
we
saying...
need to get out from behind our shields to talk. One of the things in my book, The Sacred Female, that makes it different is that there is intimate talk in the bedroom.
Okay.
And there's also God in the bedroom, too. I've crossed the literary Rubicon in two places there. And, of course, I also talk about female ejaculation.
Well, that's only in, you know, Judeo-Christianity. I mean, if goddess advocates, you know, well, we sort of think, you know, goddess was in the bedroom and should stay in the bedroom. But, you know, but that sort of natural way of looking at things, you know, became taboo thanks to, you know, Christianity. But so you're saying, I mean, I know when we were on Facebook, you were saying most men treat women like blow-up dolls. They're getting their pleasure, so why change?
Right.
And I'm reading what you wrote me. The reason is the power available to them in treating their women with respect and reverence, much as the early sacred whores were treated. Then men believe the power received came from some god with whom the sacred whore associated herself. But if he only knew if he treated his wife the same way, he'd still get the power. More, in fact, the power resides in women, accessible to men through love. So you're saying Rianne has to go, you know, in her teachings. Well, you know, she has the book Sacred Pleasure.
I've read that.
So I'm wondering, and I have to admit, I have not read it, because I was more interested in sort of the socio-political partnership aspect. But I wonder if she goes there in Sacred Pleasure, that it's beyond the partnership is the sacred sexuality.
Nor does she get to the power that's available to both. I can't speak for women. Okay, I'm speaking as a guy to guys for guys.
Okay.
I'm telling you guys, there's a lot of power in that lady. Okay, start respecting it and revering it.
Revere it.
Yes.
Well, listen, I would like to continue this conversation, but we're starting to run out of time, and I definitely want to get to one last question. When we were communicating on Facebook, you were talking about Isis and Osiris, and I found that really interesting. You said you think Isis and Osiris were real people, later deified.
Yeah.
Can you just sort of quickly talk about that?
Sure. The word agape, which we now interpret as unconditional love, God's unconditional love, originally in the early Greek referred to the kind of love that existed between Isis and Osiris, the unconditional love that existed between these two, these so-called legendary rulers of Egypt, the pre-dynastic rulers. I know the power, the kind of power that is available, okay, from this kind of love, from this unconditional love of respect and reverence, each for the other. I mean, it's not just men respecting women, it's women respecting the men, too.
Mm-hmm,
not because of how much they got in their wallet, but because of the power that they have available within them that can be accessed by that woman.
So you're saying that Isis and Osiris, beyond just being archetypes, because I know in their archaeology they say that Isis and Osiris, you know, taught men and women to love one another. They created civilizations. But you think they were real people later deified. You even said you think Osiris was crucified. Were you talking in metaphor? Or I'm just curious where this all comes from.
He was actually drawn and quartered, okay, and scattered up and down the Nile.
Oh, you mean by his brother, that where he was dismembered story?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay, that's what you're talking about. Okay,
right.
I thought
he was. He was the first one to die for love, okay, for this unconditional love. Jesus was another to die for this unconditional love, okay?
Okay, okay.
And what I'm saying is that it's there, it's real, it's powerful, and it's far more powerful than nuclear weapons as far as I'm concerned.
Well, Art, I am there with you. If we could really get to the point on this planet where Christians were really more Jesus-like and they really did act like Jesus and it was about love and men and women were about love, if we were all about love, wow, what a difference the whole world would be, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm doing this to make a happier world to live in, that's all.
Oh, absolutely, and That's
I want a happier world
too.
To live in.
Well, just quickly, because we literally have like 3 minutes. Where can we find your book, The Sacred Female? And just real quickly, what is sort of the theme? I mean, it's a story about a man and it's a love story?
It's yes. It turns out to be that. I mean, they just bump into each other in a mall in Fort Lauderdale. And you know, they have a number of dinners there at the mall. She owns a boutique, and he eats with her on a regular basis there at the mall, and they talk, you know, for a half hour, hour at a time. It's not, and there's nothing sexual going on for months.
Yeah.
And then they decide to go out on a date, and boom, it happens. This guy is in denial. He's in denial. You know, he's a typical guy.
Well, you say it's steamy, it's romance, it's mystery. Best of all, it shows how the power of sexual love works in the lives of Richard and Janine. So, Art, real quick, because we're going to go off the air here, how do people find out about your website and your other show and your book? How do they find you?
www.thesacredfemale.com. You can buy an e-copy from me. You can get it on Kindle from Amazon. You can get the hard copy on Amazon. You can get it from me. You can get it from my publisher at Trafford.com, www.trafford.com. Look for The Sacred Female. And that's the easiest way.
Okay. All right. Well, Art, it has been a pleasure. I love knowing you're out there.
Thank you.
There's another guy out there like my husband. Thank you, Goddess, for my husband. I think he would agree with most of everything you said. And we just need to clone you guys. That's all.
Well,
no, we have to teach more men out there what you know.
Yes. I'm definitely into that, and teaching women, too, because a lot of them are locked up and closed down, just like men are.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely,
it's,
without a doubt.
It's social.
I mean, yeah, I mean, women are wounded just like men are wounded,
oh,
and
yeah.
We really, you know, like you said, you know, the love can make it all right. Well, I am going to have to say goodnight to you, Art. It has been a pleasure. I thank you for coming on the show, and I have enjoyed our conversation, and I hope that, you know, we will talk again.
I hope so, too, Karen. Thank you very much for having me here tonight, and maybe I can get you on my show.
Okay. I do lots of radio interviews, so I'd be happy to do that.
Wonderful.
Well, listeners, thank you for tuning in again this Wednesday, and I will just quickly leave you with a goddess affirmation in the probably 90 seconds we have left. The peace of goddess is expressing in me, divinely guided. I move with confidence and compassion. I claim my innate health, wholeness, beauty, and sexuality. I live in an abundant universe where there is enough for everyone. I seek peace. I speak peace. I seek love. I speak love. I live from a peaceful, loving heart. Well, good night, listeners, and I will see you again. I will talk to you again next week, where we have Vicki Noble on the show. She's going to talk about matriarchal societies and their resurgence. And Lauren Time is going to talk about surviving the collapse. And on the 26th, we have Laura Flanders on the show from Grit TV. She's going to be talking about liberals, Sarah Palin, and the Tea Party. So thank you for tuning in, listeners, and please tune in again next Wednesday.
Thank you.
Sing
good night, Ellen.
Through my